and how someone could come as far as this guy did, and you're going to hear it in the story. Help me welcome Tom Ide.
Joe, thank you very much, buddy. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, and delighted to see you. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and it really is great to be here. Like Joe, I got a lot of things I'm grateful for. I was just out there walking while I go let my head clear and my heart fill, I hope. And I noticed a wedding going along next door, and I just stopped and counted my blessings that it wasn't mine. And I already got one. That's enough. And I am really, really grateful to be here. And by the way, that thing when I invited the guys from New Jersey to come down, I put a real criteria on it. I said, you can bring everybody in New Jersey if you want to, as long as they can fit in two rooms and ride in one car, because that's all the money I got, man. We can't afford anything else. And they only brought the eastern shore of New Jersey, I think. God, we had more New Jerseyites than we have down there on retirement. Well, not quite, yeah, but we had a bunch, and we had a great time. I am really delighted to be here, and I appreciated our session this morning. That was some excellent stuff, and really and truly appreciated that, and caught my undivided attention. That's for doggone sure. Appreciate a little time with John and Lori. One reason I had to take a walk in the parking lot, we got talking about our area structures and the service and effectiveness thereof and all that kind of thing. And God, we could have been there half a day talking about those kind of things. But I gotta get back into the mood to do a lot of drinking and grunting and throwing up and jails and psych units and you name it. I probably won't go there. Let me get one thing. I need to get comfortable about something. According to our schedule, I have 20 minutes to go. Now, we're going to do a quick group conscience. I can either get us back on schedule by quitting 20 minutes from now, or I can kind of forget about that and go to sort of what would comfortably fit into the hour we were going to do. Any sense of the group or leadership or anybody about which one you'd rather do? All right, don't blame me now. I didn't even vote. I tell you what I'd like to do. It's kind of like Joe was saying, we don't always have to go through our chronology and whole biography. I've got a lot of things on my mind. I've been enormously blessed for the last 45 years with a way of life that for me has never gotten dull. You know, I'm somebody who got turned on fairly early in my sobriety, and I absolutely got on that Roman candle to sobriety and to a real life in recovery that has never stopped. You know, I'm somebody who believes, you know, you hear a lot of times that you can pretty well predict your experience in AA, that when you come in, you go through a little uncertain period, then if it clicks for you, you'll get on a pink cloud, and that'll last for a fairly predictable period of time, and then it levels off to mediocrity or something. My experience has not been that. My experience has been that I got on a pink cloud, rocketed to fourth dimension, and I've stayed there. I haven't come down because my belief is that it lasts as long as I do the things that put me there. And when I quit doing the things that put me there, of course I'm going to come down. And so I'm a guy that's had a tremendous, tremendously blessed recovery. I listened to my story and I can't believe it. I swear to God. I mean, I lived it and I can't believe it. So I'm going to just tell you a bunch of it. I got three things on my mind that I really would like to just kind of visit around and kind of, I guess, just follow up on what we're talking about this morning. One, I would like for you to let me just share the story with you, but a fairly condensed version of that. I try to not drink too long, and I did it long enough before I got here. That's for doggone sure. But I want to give you a kind of a condensed version of that, and then concentrate on a couple of areas that I'd really like to just kind of visit with you a little bit about. One is the thing of what was it that worked for me so that I was able to catch this golden ring called sobriety in a maximum custody penitentiary with everything really redeeming locked out and me locked in. You know, what was it that made that thing catch with me, and what was it that made it stay? Now, I don't know if I can answer that definitively, but I can share my experience along that way and things that I've come to believe about, because that's what we're devoted here to. There's nobody here today that's not devoted to trying to make a difference with a guy or gal who's locked up in that kind of situation. And there's not a one of us who's not baffled and frustrated about why it doesn't work more often than it does. And so I'd like to visit that neighborhood just a little bit, just share some experience that's mine. Then the other thing I'd like to do is sort of come to commonality with what we're about here and share with you some of the things that in the fellowship. Let me introduce myself a little bit more. I'm the alternate DCM in District 52 of Area 51 till December, and then I'll rooster out of that. I'm the area chair for Correctional Facilities Committee in North Carolina, and I'll rooster out of that in December. And, God, I may come down off to... No, I won't. I've got other jobs waiting in January, so I won't be coming down. And so I've got a lot of concerns in our fellowship about what we do, and so I want to share with you some experience from the North Carolina standpoint. Stacy talked about a number of things. So I just want to visit with some of those. So those are the three areas that I'd like to kind of get in, so let me get going. I'm a guy... Let me kind of start backward. You know, I came to my senses locked up in a maximum custody penitentiary. And I'll assure you, just like anybody else, I never planned to be there. That was certainly not in my game plan when I started looking at what I wanted my life to be. And when I came to my senses and realized I'm a 24-year-old guy and I'm sitting looking at a life that should have been just getting out of the starting blocks, and it's over. It's over. You know, I'm banished like a wild animal somewhere and locked up like a depraved lion or something. And, you know, what happened? You know, what happened? What on earth went wrong with that? And so I spent a little time taking a look at it. And in a nutshell, what it looked to me like is that I was one of those types of people who looked like an alcoholic from day one. I wasn't, I don't think. You know, it's like our book says that we probably could have stopped drinking up to a certain point had we really wanted. I think I was one of those. I think there was a period when I could have stopped drinking, but I never did stop and look at it. I just kept on boogieing. When I was 16 years old, I started hitting the hooch, and that stuff worked for me, lit me up, I mean, like the 4th of July, and I just fell in love with it. Yeah. And so my life just started to absolutely happen like a runaway train. No real plan, no purpose. That most important thing to me was that sort of never-ending party and that kind of looking for that nirvana that booze produced with me. And so I just got caught up in it. And I was so busy doing it that I never recognized any of the warning signals that surely must have come along the way. You know, things that said, hey, guy, you know, you're looking like you're not doing this like the average person. Waking up in jail with sickening regularity, wrecked cars, wrong state, married one time to a woman I didn't even know. I mean, some bad. That's why I got nervous about that thing over there. That'll tell you, I mean, it ought to tell you it ain't working good. Psych joint, you name it, I have probably come to in that kind of situation. And so those should have been warnings to me, but I never did sober up long enough to take a look at it. You know, I'd have moments when I would wake up and realize that I was on an incredible run of bad luck, but I honestly don't believe that I ever seriously considered that my life was out of control or that if I took one drink, I did something different than other people. I don't think that ever entered my mind. And so I was so caught up in doing it that I didn't examine what was going on. And so when I look at that life, what I see is a guy who started that bizarre kind of march at 16. 8 years later, at the age of 24, I'm living up in Detroit and Flint, up in Michigan, in conditions that I never knew existed, doing things that I never even considered that other people did, much less me. But in a relatively short span of 8 years, I moved into a way of life that was so bizarre it was unimaginable, but it became the only one that was normal for me. Anything other than that life would have been abnormal. And so I'm certainly not pleased about where I wound up, and it was incredibly fast. Last couple of years that I drank, I essentially lived on the streets. You know, I'd come up for air periodically, get some old rooming house or get a piece of a job or something. But for the last couple of years of my life, I used to say I lived by my wits, but that's stretching it just a little bit. I live by my lack of character. I know of practically nothing that a man can do that I haven't done. And you can hurry up and believe that's no macho gangster story. That's the story of an alcoholic running out of control. And I pray to my God that I never forget those final gasps of that life when I wandered the face of this earth with no place I could comfortably call home, existed by mooching off, taking off, ripping off other people, selling my blood $5 a throw, on and on. Yeah, and I'm talking about a 24-year-old guy whose life is gone. I won't elaborate on it. I'll just say this. I believe alcoholism is defined not by the external evidence. It's not defined by how many times I went to jail, how many cars I wrecked, how many wrong states I woke up in, how many psycho wards. I don't think that measures alcoholism at all. What that measures alcoholism to me is what happened to me on the inside, where as a young guy, I reached a point that I couldn't function, couldn't understand what was going on with me, could not label it to alcoholism, but lived with a total lack of self-regard, any respect, any decency, in a way that lonely existence of alcoholism, a fearful kind of an existence, that's alcoholism to me. It's what happened on the inside, not what happened on the outside. And so that's where we wound up. And it's, things started to come to it. They didn't come to halt, but things started to come to a screeching halt with me that I was thinking about it this morning when I think it was Priscilla was talking about the thing of waking up in blackouts. I don't know of anything more panic-filled than waking up from a blackout. When we go through that frantic thing of trying to put together, what on earth am I doing here? What have I done? And simply unable to answer the question. And that was a routine kind of occurrence for me, happened with regularity. And so I woke up one morning in Flint, and what got me in a maximum custody penitentiary, I woke up one morning in Flint, Michigan, and it was greeted with the fact that driving blind, drunk, blacked out up to Main Street of the city had run down and killed two people. And my response, I guess, was a very normal thing, just shock and disbelief and an utter inability to accept that information. I mean, I knew I was capable of anything, but the mind will only take in what it can handle. And my response was just, no, 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 that couldn't be. And then, of course, it was true, and I accepted the truth gradually. And then was released on bond. After 76 days, knew I would never drink again. I lasted 1.5 days. And, of course, I started to drink. My God, what else would you do? And from July to November of 56, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. And then November the 19th of 56, I had what I hope and pray was my last drink. Didn't know it was going to be, but I knew it was going to be for a long time. Because I was being tried that day on the charge of manslaughter. And I had no defense. I mean, I couldn't even testify to my own behavior. I didn't know anything about it. I had to listen to the testimony of others to hear the description of what I'd done. And it was a patently open and shut case. I mean, there's no debate. And I really thought my lawyer said it all when he told me that I should enter a plea of stand mute. I never heard of such a plea. But what an eloquent plea for somebody in a blackout. What else can you say? Stand mute. You tell me. And as I was found guilty, of course, sentenced to a max of 15 years in Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, I was not a hothouse flower. I'd been in jail God knows how many times because I don't. But there's a big difference between an overnight drunk tank or a 30-day deal in a county jail or a stockade or a pea farm and a place like where I was going, Jackson, state prison of southern Michigan at Jackson, called Jacktown by the guys up there. And I knew that was not Disneyland. I was on the street with some guys that were in and out of there, and I knew if there were people like I ran around with in there, it was not a nice place. And the day I walked in, it was like one I heard about today, that they call an institution, I think it's a zoo. has got 6,000 people locked up here in New Jersey. And when you cage that many people, I guarantee you can forget anything about management. That's a zoo. And that was what I walked in, was a zoo in that place. And that was the young guy that walked into that place absolutely resigned to the fate. And when I look back at that, and look at what happened, you know, if you can picture that guy, and I'm just giving you a little snapshot of it, but, and I'm not magnifying or minimizing any of it. I mean, I was an absolute social wrecking ball just crashing through life. And I screwed up everything I ever touched. I was not a guy that had a tragic accident on the way to a party. I was an absolute loser. And when I was loose on the street, it was like firing a weapon down the street as unpredictable as I was. And so I think it was just a matter of time till some tragic thing happened. But you picture that guy running wild like that, and then the redemption is going to come from putting him in a cage with 6,000 other folks like that and think something good is going to happen. Well, something good did. And I'm not a, you'll see later when I get into a little other stuff, that I'm not a, well, I'll just explain when I get to it, about my notions about prisons. I've been in them, or they've been in my mind every day for the last 45 plus years, and they're a matter of great concern to me from all kinds of perspectives. But what happened to start turning that around? And it's amazingly simple in some ways, profound in others. Like we were talking about CPC and PI stuff here a while ago about how we have relationships, working relationships and cooperative agreements with the professional folks who wind up dealing with alcoholics in captivity. And thank God, one of the turning points was me. Now, I don't know if it was a CPC product or what, but I had a social worker there one day call me out for an interview while I was still in processing. Talked with me about my history, told me it was obvious I had a lot of trouble with booze. I'd heard that many times. But I had never heard anything about what you do about it other than some well-intended but useless advice like, why don't you quit? And I never had been able to think of any good reason to quit. And if I did, after about 2 weeks, I couldn't remember why I quit. You know, and so it just never had occurred to me as a serious consideration. And so this guy told me that. Then he added something I never heard. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution, and I think you ought to go. Now, I don't think that bird knew one thing about alcoholism. He was just a little old rookie social worker out of Michigan State, probably the only job he could get. Didn't stay long, but thank God he stayed long enough to talk to me. Now, it might have happened with anybody. But that guy, somebody told him, when you see a guy that's got a record looks like that and it's all about drunk, tell him go to AA. So that's what he did. He did just what they taught him. He said, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. We have an AA group. You ought to go. It didn't put a noose on around my neck like we do a lot of times today. He just said, you ought to go. Like, if you're hungry, go eat. You know, it was about the way he put it. And then he sent me a note. It wasn't even a letter. It's much cheapskate. A note about that big. It said, had my whole identity on it. Ivester, 94-153-3938. That told you everything there was to know about me and where to find me at that point in my life. Every once in a while, some of us in here understand, Tommy. Every once in a while, I'll run into somebody and tell me they did a bunch of times they were, and if something comes up, I may say, what's your number? And when somebody tells me they don't remember, I tell you what, I get real worried about that. You could wake me at 3 o'clock in the morning, what's your number? It'd be a reflex action. I mean, that sucker would just jump out. So this guy went through that, told me, didn't tell me anything about it. I don't think he knew anything about it, but he sent me that little note, said you can go to your first meeting. Didn't say Groundhog Day, but that's what it was, February 2nd of 57. And I walked into my first meeting that day, about 300 guys in that group, the recovery group, Jackson Prison. The second major area I'd like to talk about was what happened to that young piece of human tragedy sitting there. You know, all I am, I'm nobody special. I'm just one other sort of shipwrecked victim on the road of life. I was just one more face in that tragic chain of human misery that marches through those places. Now, what was it that happened to cause something different to come around? And so that's what I want to try to get at a little bit with you about, because I know you devote time to that. And what is it that makes a difference? Like I say, I can't tell you definitively, but I can just tell you what happened. I was probably as lousy a candidate as you could find for Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't believe I was alcoholic. I did not believe I was alcoholic. I'm 24 years old. Who's ever heard of a 24-year-old alcoholic? I didn't have not an inkling that illness was mine. I knew I'd had a lot of trouble, but that was just sort of the occupational hazard of drinking like I did. I never connected that to alcoholism. When I heard that people talking about alcoholism being a disease, it embarrassed me. I didn't know what they were talking about. Getting drunk's not a disease. I mean, that was as foreign a concept to me as could be. It's a critical timing issue, I guess. It doesn't mean anything, but interesting to me that the American Medical Association, they never declared it as a disease, but the American Medical Association started acknowledging alcoholism, sort of nodding to alcoholism as an illness or disorder, about the time I came into AA. Now, I don't think it had anything to do with when I came in, and it sure didn't have anything to do with why I came in, but it was just kind of ironic. When I came in, alcoholism was a very largely misunderstood. Bill can tell you about it more than me, because he came in back during the Pilgrim's days. Well, almost. But it was still very much a moral thing. And being an alcoholic was not an illness. An alcoholic was a moral leper. And so I had absolutely no notion that I was alcoholic. The only reason that I went to Alcoholics Anonymous was that I just simply was beat. I was absolutely beat. And the fight was just washed out of me. And nobody was pushing me. All it took was one little nudge. I think they could have said, go join the Foreign Legion, and I would have probably gone just as dutifully as I did to Alcoholics Anonymous. They would have had about the same meaning. And so I walked in that day, 300 folk. One guy spoke to me, had an officer on the door. He read my name, Iverson. I said, yes, sir. He said, sit down. He's the only guy who spoke to me that day, except the speaker. And he didn't even know I was listening. And I sat there and listened to the first alcoholic I ever heard tell his story. I observed the first AA meeting I ever saw. And I will be ever grateful for that. Now, I wasn't grateful that day because I thought I had just stepped into a loony bin. I could not imagine what these folks were doing. I knew it was going to be a little religious. I thought somebody would be humming Amazing Grace behind the scenes somewhere. I knew there'd be a foot washing or a soul saving somewhere in there. And sure enough, they opened with a serenity prayer. Now, it's not a very long prayer, but it could have been the Sermon on the Mount to me. I mean, I thought, yeah, that's right. That's what they're going to do. And thank God for that group. It ran much like most meetings that we have. Opened it up, read some stuff, and same stuff we read today, and a little bit more. And then they introduced the speaker. The guy got up, told his story. I've heard alcoholics tell all kind of stories, and I've been one of the storytellers. But I never heard one tell anything like that. That man might have been a geek in a circus, for all I knew. I couldn't figure out why on earth a nice-looking guy, he looked pretty good if you didn't get too close to him. He didn't bear up to close examination very well, though. The boy was an ex-everything. He had done everything in the known world. He'd been a professional boxer one time, and I'll guarantee you he wasn't very good. He was one chewed up dude, I tell you. What a marvelous fellow. Yeah. He was the delegate that year from the state of Michigan to our General Service Conference. Appointed John because he has been too. He's a washed out delegate. And that was the guy that spoke. And he told that story, and I sat there thinking, why on earth is he doing that? You know, 300 hairy-legged convicts, and he's in there just bearing his soul with stuff I wouldn't have told nobody, the drunk as I'd ever been. And I had absolutely no concept of why he was doing that. And I walked out, and I will assure you I was no better than I walked in, only more confused, because I could not figure out what... If anybody had asked me what you've been doing, I'd probably said, God, you wouldn't believe it. And what's even more unbelievable is that I walked back in the next week. And every meeting we had from that point forward, I never missed a single meeting. Now, I was not a convert. I was a convict, but I was not a convert. And I know 100% why I walked back in. It certainly was not the identification with the guy. He became my first sponsor, that guy that spoke at my first meeting. Much later, he became my first sponsor. I loved him better than Peter loved the Lord. but not that day. The one thing that brought me back was the spirit that that guy communicated. It was the... I don't know if he was blessed with it or developed it or whatever, but he was as richly blessed with enthusiasm as anybody I have ever seen in my life. One of those people that you would just treasure time with. And that guy, I know, thank God we don't grill each other here. Thank God we don't have to present our credentials. Because I walked back the next week, nobody asked me why I was back or even probably noticed that I was back. I couldn't have told anybody why I was back. I just found myself going back like a magnet pulling. And the magnet was that spirit that this guy conveyed about his life. I think he demonstrated to me, not by words, but by his life, that maybe there was life after sobriety. I always thought not drinking was about the glummest, most boring thing that a human could endure. I'd never seen anybody didn't drink who didn't look like they didn't drink. I mean, they looked like they're in pain, you know. That's what brought me back to my second meeting. And for a good while, it was not a... It was not a homecoming at all. You know, for a guy like me, I was always an extremely isolated guy. You know, I mean, I made a lot of noise, and I yucked it up with people and all that kind of stuff. You know, I was a kind of a leader of the Rat Pack type of guy. But inside, I was a totally isolated fellow. Not until years after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous did I ever let one human being inside my life, and he was the first one who ever went there. So penetrating through that shell, that self-centered shell of isolation, takes more than just a little cosmetic peck and a goodbye. You know, it takes a tremendous something to cut through that. And to get to a sense, you rarely hear it talked about much, but I think it's crucial to recovery, and that's a sense of belonging. The sense of belonging. And the surest way that I know to get it is get in on the action. Get in on the action. When I work with a new person, I don't put them in the book. I won't even show them the book. What I do is put them... Let me give you an example of that. Had a guy come into... I just happened to be scheduled still for a week, and we were doing a project in a building we met in and sort of trading it up and painting and stuff. And... three of us in there working, and some guy came, knocked on the door. I knew it wasn't one of our members. He wouldn't be knocking. And I opened it up, and I swear to God, I think he was the worst looking drunk I have ever seen in my life. I mean, the man was goony. He was just as insane as a rat. I mean, he's standing out there. He looked like a bad Columbo. You know, he had an old trench coat hanging sideways, and somebody had bloused his eye big time. I mean, he looked like a mule had kicked him. And he was just shaking. I mean, he was barely speaking. He says, "This AA?" I said, "Yeah, come on in. I think you'll fit." And so he came in the door, and I mean, he's quaking. Now, you know that place in the promises that says we will intuitively know how to handle situations that baffle? Now, I'm no rocket scientist. But what are you going to do with a guy like that? You'd have to hogtie him if you're going to try to talk to him. And what would you talk to him? You'd have to speak Farsi to get through to that guy. And so I looked him over a minute, and I intuitively knew what to do. I said, "Can you paint?" he said, "Paint, paint, paint." I said, "Yeah, paint like we're doing." He said, "I don't know." I said, "Man, you are natural. The way you're shaking, you'll get that stuff off." and he said, "I'll try." And sure enough, he grabbed that paintbrush, and I, God knows, St. Vitus painted that thing. He was all over the building. He got started, and I said, can you climb that ladder? No. I can't go up that ladder, man. I said, I don't worry about it. I'll hold the ladder, and I'll catch you if you fall. So here's this guy going up that ladder, hanging on for dear life, painting that wall. Here's the picture of Alcoholics Anonymous and the mystifying quality of it. On the ladder in the other end of the building, I literally had a brain surgeon. And I had a yo-yo in the middle that I wouldn't have trusted on a ladder, drunk or sober. I wouldn't even trust him with the ladder. Those two guys on the ladder, one of them is sober today. Excuse me. One of them tragically died drunk. Reckon which one? Yeah. Strange, isn't it? I don't think there's any commentary on anything. It's just how elusive this thing is and how important it is to have that sense of connection, that sense of belonging. And physical activity, to me, is the isolation breaker. It's not therapy. It's the therapy of doing something. If you guys help pick that table up, it does something for belonging. That little exercise we did this morning in the warm-up deal, Yeah, what that did was it did break the ice. You know, those of us who, by the time we got through asking those questions, felt like a group. So physical activity, tremendously important. And I like to keep that in mind because it was so important to me that the guys in that group, the recovery group that I went into, was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. By any measure, it was an excellent group. I mean, it was well-founded in all legacies, in steps, in traditions. When I went in, guys in the program introduced me to the steps, and I'm talking about other guys in the joint. I'm not talking about us rocket scientists from outside. You know, they would come in and get us pumped up and all that stuff. But I was led into my introduction to the design for living that's laid out in the steps by other guys. The only difference between me and them, they were in front of me a bit. Tremendously important. That thing that started to happen where guys came together. Tell you this, I have literally been to meetings all around this world. Some of the finest meetings I have ever been to in my life were when six or eight of us guys would bunch up around some little something out on the yard and have meetings like few folks ever experience. Powerful stuff. Powerful stuff. Some of those guys not only had enormous influence in my life, some of them are my dear friends today. And so the point is that, you know, I believe that men and women in prison recover 100% exactly the same as me and you. Nothing different. They don't recover from education. They don't recover from inspiration. Those things all help. But our program is sort of described as experiential learning. Experiential learning. We learn by doing. And that was the thing that started to happen there. It's incredible to me that In that group of 300 guys in a maximum custody joint, I experienced that sort of innate sensitivity that exists in a well-formed group. I'm talking about a little snacky meeting where you just get together and chat. I'm talking about a well-defined, purposeful group. Amazing how a sensitivity sets in. And in that crowd, those guys, now I don't think anybody had plans when they said, let's do this to Tom next and then that. You know, but they're just sort of an instinctive reaction. And it's amazing to me how those guys sort of gently led or nudged or pushed or whatever it took to get into the business of recovery, to get into the business of serving. Nobody ever asked me if I wanted to do it, if I wanted to stand for something. Guys just said, hey, come on, here's what we're doing. Go with us. I didn't know any better. I just went. And in a fairly short period of time, a couple of things happened to me that were tremendously important. What time did I start? I don't even know. It's now 1 o'clock. Well, all right, I'll just hurry. A couple of things started to happen. And I guess the point of this is how important a group is. Not a gathering of eagles, but how important a group is that's purposefully organized. Stacy said it well this morning, that you have to fit the reality of the setting you're working in. And in a place like mine, I mean, man, average time was probably life in that place. I mean, ain't nobody going nowhere. And so we were able to develop an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous, as fine as any I've ever seen. And my basic belief is this, and I'll throw it in right now because I'll forget it later. One of the keys to me in working with a group in that kind of setting is that I ought not do anything for those folks that they can and should do for themselves. And I don't care what it is. Whether it's running a meeting, buying literature, cleaning up, speaking, whatever. Anything that they are capable of doing for themselves, if I step in and do it for them, I'll interfere with the recovery instead of facilitating it. I'll give you an example of that. I was over in your town one night, Stacy, and we decided to go out to Huntersville to one of our units that's now closed. And interesting when you sort of sit back and observe something. Now, we were a group of real sort of spiritual giants riding up in there in the car. Jeez. If you knew that crew, you'd know we were not spiritual giants. We were buzzards descending. And so we drove up. Now, get the picture. You know, this is kind of a light custody place. Well, sort of semi-light. So we pull up, and the guys started getting stuff out of the trunk of their car. They got out the coffee pot, coffee, books, everything. And so the guys in the group, the inmates, were lined up along the sidewalk on the other side to say hello. So I'm standing there watching that. They wouldn't let me carry anything. I was the visitor. And the officer opened the gate, and we walked in. And I watched the inmates watching us. And we go walking in like we're serving a meal or something. You know, we're taking this stuff in there. And I had just a little bit of commentary about that sometime during the night. That, were we serving? Yeah. There wasn't a single person in that lineup to greet us who wouldn't have leaped at the opportunity to say, let me carry that thing. But they get used to us doing for them, and they get to thinking they can't carry anything. And so, you know, when going in, you know, I like to keep that in mind, is that my job is like when I sponsor an individual, that I'm not going to carry that fellow forever and teach him forever. I'm going to start getting him into some concerted work in the program, developing the program of recovery. And I believe a sponsored group the same way, that if it's an environment where a group can happen, the greatest service I can do is help that bunch of folks become a real solid group. I like to walk into a prison where it feels best to me. Where I'm interested in that word host. I haven't had a chance to ask anybody yet, but I'm really interested. It's the first time I've ever heard it used in the context I think it's being used here. I'm real interested in that. And so maybe somebody will tell me before I get out of here what that's about. Because what I like to see is a group of inmates be the host. And so when I walk into a prison and inmates come over to me and say, we're really glad to have you here. Have you ever been here before? No. Well, the bathroom's over there. The coffee's here. Come on over here and I'll help you get something you got. Then you know you're walking into a group, eh? Walking into a group. And so one of the great services to me is to be able to help guys and gals develop a real group. Because the value, the power of the work that I do will be multiplied by the number of folk there. And so, tremendous investment. I'll just throw this in that we'll jump, leapfrog way ahead a little bit and sort of verify what I'm talking about a little bit. We say it, and I think it's true, that a person who is intensely involved in doing this program of recovery as outlined in this set of principles, there's hardly room to drink. Hardly room to drink. I don't know of anybody that I have ever personally worked with who said, well, I was intensively doing this part there, and I knew it to be so, and I just found myself drinking. I have never observed that. There's just not much room for failure when I'm doing this thing as it's laid out. I had a group of guys one time years ago, and you know some of them, a group of guys that I was working with in our main prison in North Carolina, trying to put a group together and get her moving. And we were able to do it. There were 10 guys who were intensely involved in that process with me. That's been somewhere around 35, 37 years ago that we were doing that work. As of today, every single one of that 10 are either sober or died sober. And I'm talking about average guys in your average maximum custody joint having anything but an average experience. See, I believe that what we're doing here is powerful. It's a powerful thing. We don't need to have gimmicks and curves and angles to make it fit institutions. The program as it's laid out will do phenomenal work, I believe. And that's what was tremendously important to me. Yeah, I wasn't looking forward to becoming an AA member when I got out. I became an AA member in the fullest sense while I was still in the maximum custody joint. There's not a single thing that I've ever done in this program that I didn't do right there. What a wonderful opportunity for CPC work, with helping the staff understand what they're running there, you know, and how to go about being supportive of this, how to work relationships with people. Public information, my God, there'll never be a better place. 12-step work, good God. No shortage whatsoever. Point is that nothing that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous can't be done in an institution. At least I've never found it yet. I'm somebody who is very reluctant. I've never worked with a bunch of group of inmates very long in a group that didn't want to write rules. When you start getting that kind of developing thing, first thing you want to do is write a rule book. And if you let them write a rule book, it'll be tougher than the one the prison's got. Strange thing. I found that there's absolutely nothing that happens in a group that our traditions is not equal to and can guide us through it. And so a real group of Alcoholics Anonymous is my goal. And if it hadn't been for that, I guarantee you I wouldn't be here today. I want to mention this one thing about outsiders. And I mean, that's what we are. I guess all of us are. Any inmates in here? I mean, current inmates here? You never know. I mean, you can't tell them if you can't smell them. I don't mean that ugly. I mean, that's like I say about new folk. You can't tell them if you can't smell them. I tell you about the value of outsiders. A thousand ways I could tell it, but let me put it this way. You know, prison environment is a strange place, and I understand every bit of this today. The one I was in was not a nice place. It simply wasn't. It was a place that was filled with tension and fear and hate 24 hours a day. There was never any other climate or any other environment. It was truly a dangerous place for anybody who was in there, and I know that. Absolutely know it. I think one of the most helpless, futile feelings I've ever had in my life was sitting locked in a cell one night and listening to a guy get his brains beat out with a hammer. Nothing about it. Can do nothing about it. No, so it's not a pet shop. You know, it's a very, very, in those kind of places, very, very tough and difficult environment. I know you've got some of that here. At that prison, they had a policy that if tour groups, you know, some people want to tour penitentiaries and see what they're like, and I understand that. And the way you toured that prison was they had the old flat top roof construction, Robert, where, and they would bring the tour groups in and they would walk them around the tops of the buildings, looking over into the pit at the guys. Well, now I fully understood that. But understanding it does not change the way it makes you feel. I knew what that meant in terms of how far I was from a real world and where my position was in life. Let me tell you the one place where that didn't happen, the one place that I know of where that didn't happen, and that was in the group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because Alcoholics Anonymous didn't get on top of the roof and talk down to the folks. The guys who came into that facility walked in right into the middle of the pack. I don't know if they knew it or not, but they couldn't have been safer in their mother's arms. I know they didn't all know it. I know there was a guy came one day that, ironically, he's the first guy that I ever identified with in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody loaded up a guy, big old sort of a Well, anyway, he was a furniture salesman. I don't think he'd ever driven by a jail. He'd certainly never been in one. And I believe the guys told him they were going on a picnic or something. I don't think he knew where they were going. And so, first thing you know, he's standing in the middle of Jackson Prison. I mean, scared, slammed to death. Scared to death. And they got him to get up and speak. I heard you guys this morning talking about looking behind you to see. This guy's exactly what he did. He was so scared that he spoke in a falsetto. It sounded like Tiny Tim. You know, his voice would just squeak. And the whole time he's talking, he's looking to see if anybody's sneaking up on him. And he never came back. But thank God he came one time, because that's the first guy that I ever identified with. I didn't identify with Charles Manson or John Dillinger or somebody. I wasn't a gangster or a thug. You know, I'm an alcoholic who just simply went the step beyond where most of us go. That's all. And so I didn't identify with those Wild West stories and all that kind of stuff. I identified with somebody whose life fell apart. And that's who I identified with. Yeah, and so when people came in like that, God, what a lifeline. What a tremendous lifeline. Of people who came in, and man, I tell you, I could talk to you all day about people that were absolutely monumental figures in my life, some of whom are still my dear friends too. One of the unbelievable, many unbelievable dreams that have come true in my life. I didn't even dream about this, but I used to look at those guys who came in and spoke. I thought they were, I didn't know what they were doing there. First, I thought maybe they were sort of an executive committee of Alcoholics Anonymous that came around making speeches. I didn't understand anything about the service stuff and all that. Today, and for a good number of years now, it's been my great privilege to go and share in doing program with the same guys who carried it to me all around the place. Just a while back, I did a workshop up in Montreal with the guy who spoke at my fifth meeting of AA. First man I ever heard put words to how I felt. Yeah. And so, powerfully important people, people who came into my life that I trusted implicitly and never had to trust violated, not a single time. Tremendously important. People who reached out to me when I had absolutely nothing to put in their hands. Who reached out to me with an unquestioning, totally accepting hand of fellowship with no hooks to it. I never had one single person that I met who came into that facility who even asked me an inappropriate question. Like, what are you here for? Or how long you got? Or under that kind of stuff. Or what are your motives? I never had anybody do that. Some people talk about the old days when they put you up against the wall. That never happened to me. Absolutely never happened to me. You know, I was introduced to this program in a very gentle, loving kind of way. I was treated with dignity and respect a long time before I ever operated in that world. And so this message is about a message of love. It's not a message of intimidation or regimen or that kind of stuff. And tremendously important to me, those folks who came to my life and have remained part of my life ever since. And so that, I won't go into all of the stuff underneath that, but just that some powerful stuff happened. You know, that's a funny thing about alcoholics. We're folk that, now not all of us, but most of us tend to be people who don't need anybody to say giddy up to them. You know, once we get sober, giddy up is a given. You know, I mean, we're usually, you got to slow us down. You got to say whoa to us. Hey, we want to get three jobs. We don't want to just get one. We want to get three jobs, you know, and pay off everybody one time. And that sort of compulsive drive gets shifted somehow. Well, that was no different for me. And I'll tell you this one little vignette, and then I'll get into the third segment and then quit. I got turned on to living, man. I absolutely came alive in there. And some of the finest, most rewarding days of my life were in a maximum custody joint. I experienced every reward that Alcoholics Anonymous offered. I became a free man in a maximum custody penitentiary. I experienced joy for the first time in my entire life in a maximum custody penitentiary. So I had a transforming experience, and it was not because bells rung anywhere. It's because these principles work. And I don't care what the situation is, these principles work. And they will set me free, and that's what this program is about. And so when I got sober, I got turned on. I was a guy that, I won't get into any illicit substances. I did then, but I was not a drug addict particularly. I was a speed freak. And I wasn't hooked on speed. I was hooked on parties. And that stuff, that was a predecessor of cocaine. I guess it just sort of, it made the party last. You know, I was the kind of guy, I'd get on one of those tears and go about 4 days till it would just absolutely run out. And then I'd crash and disintegrate for, wake up, big old circles under my eyes, look like a raccoon. And that stuff does something to your head. I mean, it'll fry your cells a little bit, I think. And when I got sober, I found that I couldn't handle a totally dark room. Because I get in a dark room, I'm not afraid of boogers, but I get in there and I hear stuff and there's nothing going on. And I close my eyes, it's like a kaleidoscope, you know, just a wash of colors going in. And I thought, Jesus, I'm going to go nuts. I couldn't sleep. Now, when you're locked up in a rough and tough joint like that, you don't want the word to get out that you're afraid of the dark. You know, that's somebody will take you under their wing, you know, if you're that scared. That. So I'd act like I'm sleeping. Well, that's murder, you know. And one day I was at a meeting. You talk about some profound philosophy. I had a meeting one day, and a guy said, I had a lot of trouble when I first got sober. Well, my ears just perked. They're big enough, but they perked up. And I said, God, tell me. And he said, I tell you what happened to me. He said, I heard a guy say one time, if you can't sleep, stay awake. Jesus. I said, God, where you been, Einstein? How dumb can you get, my God? Till I stopped and thought, how brilliant. It was what I'm doing anyway. Only I'm fighting it. And so I said, geez, that makes sense. So I started staying awake. I enrolled in Michigan State University. They had this camp was coming down on television. All I had to do was buy some books, pay some tuition. And I became a freshman at Michigan State University while I couldn't sleep. I finished 2 years of my college education while I couldn't sleep at Michigan State University. And so that's what happened, you know, when that energy kicks in and life starts to happen. Finally got out of that place. This commentary I think you would understand about what I'm talking about that kind of life. Now, I hated prison as much as anybody I've ever met. I absolutely detested everything about every second of that existence. I had a couple of folks crazy enough to tell me that I would get used to it. It obviously takes longer than 3.5 years because I was less used to it the day I walked out than I was the day I walked in. And I absolutely despised that. When I left, deep in the pit of my soul, I promised myself that I would never go through that indignity again, no matter what the cost. I would do whatever it took to never go through that. Many years later, I feel exactly the same. That fervor is not diminished one bit. And that's what I meant. I would do whatever it took. But as much as I hated it, the night before I was leaving, it didn't take long to pack. I didn't have too much, but I was starting to pack up and getting ready to go the next morning, and I found myself thinking, "Geez, I just wish I had one more day. I got a lot of stuff I need to finish up. I was secretary of the A group, and I got a lot I need to do." Now I didn't tell anybody that. I wouldn't have given one more second in that place. But isn't it great when you can be caught up so much in a program that even under those conditions, you're not thinking in terms of, God, if I can just get out of here. Yeah. I point out one other thing about this thing about, and I won't have time to dwell on it, but please think about this a little bit because I think it's crucial to the work we do, at least in my view. You never know who you're working with in a prison. And I don't mean their lineage or resume. I'm not talking about that. You never know who you're talking to. One of the things that happens to folk when they go into a prison, it happened to me, it happens to everybody, is that we sort of take on a survival mode. You know, you watch some little frail kid get in there, he's afraid he's going to get devoured by the wolves. First thing he's going to do is go to the weight pile, you know, start working out, trying to muscle, you know, just muscle up, you know, and look bad. Yeah, everybody's got their own way of surviving. And I guess that learned folk call it affect. You know, it's what we do. It's what we project to protect ourselves. And I'll tell you, I'd studied it in college in correctional administration, but I never really understood it until I heard a guy one day that, you know, just my own experience, but I was interviewing a guy one day, and I called him by his name, and he was getting ready to get out, and he said, "Mr. Iverson, you know," he said, "do you know that that's not my name?" And I said, "Well, of course your name, we got it right here in your record." He said, "No, that's not my name." I said, "Well, why do we have it?" He said, "When I came in to the system, they got it wrong, and I didn't want to cause any trouble, so I just went by that name." Now listen to the message of that. Listen to the message. The most important sound in any language in the world is the sound of a person's own name. This guy didn't want to cause any trouble, so he wouldn't even bother to tell anybody that's a mistake. And I think that's what happens a lot to the life, that most of us go into the place there, and the most predominant pressure that we feel is how to avoid being liquefied and remolded into some different creature. And so what you see is two levels of a person. I don't want to get psychological about that, but you see two levels of a person. One is the survival face that the person has on. Of how do I get through this thing without getting devoured? And then where I really live. And they may be light years apart. Light years apart. And it's the frustrating thing when we're going in there and we try to just verbally talk about thinking we're going to reason and penetrate that. And why I believe it's so critically important to push past that into experiential learning, because that comes from the inside. And it has a lot of influence on me about how I try to go about working with folk, of getting on the inside of that thing. And I tell you what I ran into one time again, that just, even when I was in there, that gave me some real clear evidence. The last job that I had in the institution, I was telling somebody today, Joe, I believe, I was a barber. Now, I was not a barber, but barbers were the richest guys in the joint, and so I became a barber. Couldn't cut hair worth a flip. That's dangerous when you start messing up folks' hair. And I cut the top of one guy's ear off while I was cutting his hair. I didn't think it was bad. He did, but I... Plus, the garber's also the only guy in there with a razor, legally. And so I was a barber. And the last part of, before I left out, I was the guy who gave people their going-home haircut. Now, there's a time when you can talk to somebody, right? Yeah, get them in there. And I'd usually wait till I had the razor on their neck, you know, just to make sure they didn't break bad or anything. And I'd say, "Well, enjoyed being with you in the AA group. You have to see somebody in the group. Enjoyed being in the AA group with you." "Oh, yeah. Where are you going when you get out?" You know, try to talk with them about some getting out kind of stuff. Amazing how many times I've had guys literally with the razor on their neck turn around and look at me and say, "Man, you really serious about this stuff?" And I said, I would always say, "You better believe it, like a heart attack." It's amazing to me. Guys who look just as active to me, like guys who looked to me, guys who had far worse stories than mine. And it was as if it was a performance that had nothing to do with their life. See, that's performing at the institutional affect level, the survival level. Really important to me to recognize it's a little deeper deal than that. And so I got to try to help people get in so they can have a genuine experience that they own, and not just conformist behavior to the survival in the institution. Now, I know that's a little heavy, but just think about that a little bit, because I think it is truly one of the vexing problems that we have in trying to get. And it takes a lot to get through that, believe me. It takes a lot to get through that. I'll just wrap up with the last part. I wish we had time to talk about it, but we don't. When I got out, I hit the streets. If you're really solidly into the program, transition is not a huge challenge. It's a big deal, but it's not a huge challenge. You know, I was ready to get out. I already had my contacts worked out in North Carolina. I knew where I was going. That's critically important for folks leaving a place, and I knew it. I knew it a year ahead of time. And so when I got out, I just plugged in immediately, and all I did was just shift my membership over to another place. Now, certainly, there was more to it than that. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of adjustment and all that kind of stuff. But the important thing was that I had my lifeline intact. I never had a second when I was up for grabs and going to have to regroup and figure out what to do. I knew what I was going to do, and it was laid out, and I did exactly what was laid out. All I wanted to do was just like what most people getting out of any place, treatment or prisons or any place else. I wanted to have a life. I wanted to just little small things. I wanted to be a citizen. I never had been in my entire life. I was a guy who destroyed towns. I wasn't somebody who built towns. I'd never been a citizen. Never voted. I'd never participated in society any other way except as a destroyer, not a builder. I wanted to be a citizen. I wanted to have a place I could make a living. I truly wondered if I would ever have a friend. And that's not a melodrama. That's a fact. Whether anybody would ever trust me to do anything. So just little things like that. Got immediately active second week I was out. Somebody asked me to go over to the prison with them. I said, man, they're not going to let me in that place. Or they may not let me out. Which was just as troubling. no problem, come on. So I went. 2 months after I was out, 2 months, I was named outside sponsor of prison. I'd just gotten out of one of those suckers. Now, it was a simpler day than it is today. But nonetheless, it still was a prison. You know, and I'm just out of a maximum custody joint, and I'm an outside sponsor of one of those places. And what a tremendous thing. A guy came to one time and asked me if I wanted a driver's license back. And with a crime like mine, you imagine about how likely restoration of driving privileges is. And I when he asked me that, I said, "Are you understand my situation? And do you know about me?" And he said, "Well, of course I do." And without even asking for it, I think maybe because I didn't ask for it. A little over 2 months after I was out, my driver's license restored. Never requested it. I believe with all my heart, had I been trying to manipulate that into happening, I would be walking today. I believe that. But when we give ourselves to this simple program, it's amazing how the walls come down, whatever they are. 5 months after I was out, I was a DCM. I was elected DCM. I couldn't even spell DCM. They didn't teach that at Michigan State. So I'm the DCM. What a message, eh? The guy who wondered if he'd ever have a friend. Here are the people, and most important people in my life, other than my family, asking me to be their trusted servant. In 12 cities in my state. Tremendous message. 2 years after I was out, I got a phone call one day from the Capitol, and a guy on the phone that I'd met one time, he visited the A group that I sponsored, and he said, Mr. Ivester, he said, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system. We were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. And the first thing I said was, you know who you're talking to. And he said, yeah, we probably know you better than you know yourself. We've checked you out. And there had never been an ex-con in history hired anything like that. And I knew they weren't going to start with me, for doggone sure. But they did. In 1961, I went to work as a rehabilitation officer in the prison system in North Carolina. I was talking with Tommy today about that. It's kind of hard to talk shop when you're the only guy on the universe with that experience, you know. And so, kind of hard. I had to really rely on the principal. Thank God I had a background in traditions and understood something about how to differentiate vocation from avocation. Yeah, and those were things that I had to work out in the solitude of my own soul. Because there was nobody to talk shop with. And it launched a career, an unbelievable career. I've always been a good worker. I'm even drunk. I had people tell me I was an excellent worker when I showed up. I was not famous for showing up, but I was great when I got there. You know? So I always had the work instinct, but I also had a greater instinct to screw it up, no matter how good it was. So when I went to work, I was good at what I did, and I gave it everything I had. And an amazing thing happens when you do good work, folks want to push you up. They want to keep pushing you till they find your level of incompetence, I guess. And they kept pushing me to go into other stuff. And all I wanted to do was duke it out with the guys. I didn't want to run nothing. But they kept pushing me into management, and I finished up my education in correctional administration. Not because of the ambitious. I just got tired of being the dumbest guy in the room. And so I just finished up to catch it. My career was going so fast I couldn't keep up with it anyway. And then I started drifting into facility management. I co-directed a facility for a while. I was the operations chief, and we had a psychiatrist who was the medical chief. And then the next one that happened that was totally unbelievable. The guy that ran the system asked me to come by one day, and he asked me if I would take over an institution as warden. Now, I'll guarantee you that of all the delusions and imagination and goofiness you can have sitting thinking about your life when you're locked up, that one never makes the scene. It just never comes up. And when he told me that, I said, God, boss, I don't know if I want to do that or not. And I didn't want to be the man. I don't want to be somebody walking around with a shotgun or something. I said, will you give me some time to think about it? He said, oh, yeah, take 5 minutes. And I did. And I came back and agreed. And for the next 20 years, that's what I did. I ran institutions. A marvelous career. It's a lousy job, but the only reason I took it was not that I wanted to be the man. I just thought, and it turned out to be true, that maybe with some influence and a little bit of power, I might be able to do some things that needed done. And that certainly was the case. I had a marvelous career in that, and was able to do some real landmark work that stands to this day. That, you know, it'll never be written up anywhere, but there are a couple of facilities. Every time I take a drive by there and take a look at some innovative things that still exist at that place, I always just sort of say, yeah. Still a good career. And in the last 15 years of my career, I was able to set up an alcohol and drug program in our state. They asked me to do that before I kissed them goodbye. Was able to do that and set up what, for my money, was the finest treatment program has ever been done in the world. Because it set up a continuum of care that provided care in every segment of our system. And that was a truly landmark thing. So it was a marvelous career. It's an absolutely unbelievable career. And I'm going to close on this. I finally retired when I learned two things. One, I was the oldest guy in the system. And I never meant to do that. I had 39 years of service. And I also learned that I would make as much, if not more, money retired than I did working. So I said, well, why on earth am I doing it? And so I decided to retire. So I started working toward the retirement, named a date and pushed it back, named it again, finally did it. It'll be 2 years in December. It's amazing how AA folks have an ear to the ground. Word got out that I was getting ready to retire. And it's amazing how many jobs become in need of a fearless leader. So I was elected to be the area CFC chair to be effective the day of my retirement. And so it's a really long retirement, about a nanosecond, you know. And the only difference is I just moved the other side of the fence and quit getting paid. So now that's why I do it. I'll tell you in all seriousness what motivated me to do it, other than just that's where my life is. I'm committed to everything in our program, just like we were talking about. I'm not just a CFC freak. That's not where all of my stuff is. It's my primary personal mission. But it's no better than our fellowship as a whole. So I'm concerned about all of our service structures. But when I walked out and looked at that chair thing, the way I look at it is this, and you pay attention to it or forget it, whichever. I believe that if I look at a need that needs to be addressed, having to do with our illness, our program, if I can look at a need that needs to be addressed and know that I can address it, can contribute to it, and walk away, I'll be diminished by that experience. I'll be diminished by it. I'll pay a price for it. And so when I started to retire, I took a look. I don't know, in all candor, I don't know of anybody in the United States that's got more exposure and experience and examination of that critical thing that happens in the transition into and out of institutions than me. I don't know of anybody that's got a greater awareness about the difficulties that are presented in trying to get effective AA in there. And the other thing I was looking at, I didn't know anybody that would have as much access to the leadership of our prison system than me, because I just stepped out of the ranks. And so that's how I took off. And so what we set out, and we'll I'd be glad to tell you, send you information, anything you want to do, but what we basically set out, I wanted to do two things. And we're getting close to closure. I think we're going to make it by December 31. God, I hope so. I wanted to do two things. One, as far as my personal contribution, I wanted to raise the level at which we communicate and do business with the prison system, for one. Meaning that I wanted to get some sensitivity and some commitment from the top of our system to the bottom of our system while we had a chance to do it. And because over the years, what I've noticed is that we tend to operate in this service at the bottom of the staffing pattern. Had an employee one time told me, he said, I was talking about that, and he said, you know, you're right, Tom. He said, when I go to a facility, I always operate with the lowest level person and apologize for bothering them. Bad deal, eh? Bad deal. And so I wanted to raise that forward. I think the head of an institution is a critical player in delivering the service. Not that he has to do anything or she has to do anything or show up at meetings, but I think it is absolutely critical that the head of that institution be on record of here's where I stand on this. Otherwise, every staff member will make up their own mind about where they stand, and it'll be bad. So I approached the director of our prison system. I happened to know him, and told him I wanted to talk with him about it. Didn't want him to do anything. I just wanted him to listen to me. And then tell me if he agreed with it. So I laid out what we intended to do in AA, and I said, well, how do you feel about it? He said, hell, that makes sense. I said, well, good. Made sense to me. And he said, what do you want me to do? I said, nothing. I just want to walk out of here today with you in my back pocket. And I'm not going to drop your name. All I want to do is know that you're there. And if something happens and I need to see you again, I'll come in. But otherwise, I don't need to see you anymore. I'm done with you. And he said, well, you got to talk to others. I said, bunch them up and I'll talk to them. Because I'm broke, I got no money, I can't afford to chase folk all over this state. If you bunch them up, I'll come. He said, all right, we'll bunch them up. So we started bunching them up. And I met with every line manager in North Carolina. I met with every superintendent and warden in North Carolina in bunches. Now, I couldn't chase them down. That'd have been the rest of my life trying to do that. And what we wanted to do was to start raising the bar on how we do business with that system. If we had not had that meeting with the director of prisons, there wouldn't have been a second meeting. I guarantee you that. There would not have been a second meeting. He understood that. So that's what we're in the throes of doing right now. We are Monday, day after tomorrow. I say we because they asked me to help draft it, but the prison system in North Carolina is drafting a whole new policy that deals with nothing but AA and NA people about how we access facilities. It'll no longer be lumped in with volunteers. It'll be a policy that specifically addresses AA and NA folks. It will have the flexibility that Stacy was talking about, so that, you know, we're not blessed with resource people everywhere. We've got facilities that have no help whatsoever. And so what we're going to do is take our resource base and make it mobile so that we can take places where there are resources and spread them around to places that have no resources. And so we'll be able to address the needs of our system. Tremendously important. And the other thing that we're deep in the throes of is that I think you guys are probably a little better off here than us, but we tend to not do business in a very business-like way with these systems. And so what I wanted to do was to sort of lead the charge toward us being more planful and thoughtful about how we put services together and how we coordinate and deliver those services. And we examine a lot of stuff in our service structure and all that kind of stuff, but very important for us to start doing business in a way that's business-like. A lot of times we go in, and you hear this all the time. You won't hear it from me. Well, it's their prison. You know, if you don't like something, well, it's their prison. It's their house. We have to do it their way. That's right to a point. But I would remind you that we also have principles that hold us together in wellness as a fellowship. And when we go into a facility and we compromise our standards to modify and fit into a prison to fit that reality, we're making compromises that are tremendously expensive. And so I think there's an awfully important place for negotiating and finding a meeting ground, recognizing that they've got a job to do and we've got a job to do, and those things are not in conflict. So, a lot more to that. Don't have time to talk about it today. I'm going to leave. Some of the guys know how to get in touch with me. I got some cards. Anybody wants to get in touch, talk about any of those things, I'll give you my email, phone, all that kind of stuff. That's what I bought them for, and you're welcome to use them. I'll send you anything I can send on email. Don't like to lick stamps, you know. So any of that stuff that you'd like to talk any more about, I'd be delighted to hear from you. And I am just thrilled to be here with you. Thanks for a good job.